This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Today on the Breakfast Grill, I'm talking to Cheryl Hamdan, the Deputy Chief of UMNO Youth, and Thama Pele, the co-founder of Undi 18, which is a social enterprise championing a youth-centric agenda focusing on democratic reforms. Gentlemen, Cheryl, Thama, thank you for talking to me. Now, we are, of course, having a panel discussion highlighting the concern that the pandemic might have accelerated the decline in chances for the youth, that the youth will bear the greatest consequences from the socio-economic fallout, not the old. So let's start with jobs, yeah? Unemployment, big issues, already a national crisis years ago. Now, Cheryl, let's start with you. Where does the nation stand on this big thorny issue today?
I think the nation stands at the precipice of something that could be disastrous. I hate to sound dramatic at the very start of the interview, but looking at the numbers, looking at stats, and just anecdotal conversations with people in the industry, it just seemed that unemployment, especially for young people, already at double digit before the pandemic, is not about to get any better. Things that the government has done have slowed down, perhaps, the trend that it would have been. I mean, the acceleration that would have been, but it's still accelerating. And I'm just quite concerned that we haven't found the political will to make the necessary investments and decisions and government spending that would slow down or solve this problem from making it much worse.
Yeah, I mean, the political impasse right now and the fragility of the whole structure seems to be one of the reasons why, Cheryl, you have described the situation as it is. Thama, from your perspective and from your work in Undi 18, what other ingredients can you add to this whole conundrum that is facing the youth today?
I think it's really a systemic issue, in my opinion, how we've underfunded in terms of education, how there's a culture and a system of political patronage that that disallows or makes it very difficult for young people to get into certain types of entrepreneurship or compete for certain types of contracts, right? So these are issues of the politicization of our system that makes it very difficult for our economy to break out of that mold that we're in right now. And I echo what Cheryl said, that we are really just going on a very, very negative path. It's going to hit us really hard. And this pandemic has only made a bad situation even worse. When PH came into power, one of their promises was to try to come and reform this and do economic reforms. Unfortunately, this is one of the many areas that they failed to do it. They promised that reforms, but it's never come. So those reforms have to be done. It's necessary. I can speak more about what are the exact reforms that need to be done. But suffice to say this, that currently the current unemployment rates announced in May is 5.3%, which is the highest in almost 30 years. And while we don't have the official numbers yet, it wouldn't surprise me if unemployment rates for young people in particular was probably around 15%, because it's three times the national unemployment rate. So this is a real crisis that can spill over into a political and social crisis if we don't fix it.
Well, the academic Bridget Welsh pointed out that the teenage job seekers, 15 and 19 years old, are nearly two times more likely to be jobless. And we know this from the corporate world. It's LIFO, right? Last in, first out. Cheryl, you know, you head the youth arm of what is essentially one of the country's biggest, if not one of the biggest, political parties in Malaysia. From a policy perspective, and I think you try to do this with a shared prosperity vision, what more needs to be done for the youth?
So I've been on your program. By the way, I think Thama's right. The youth unemployment figures will be way bigger. In fact, if I remember right, 2019 was at 14%. So you can imagine what it is today. Also, the official unemployment figures, while it says 5.3%, I just saw it the other day when Stats Department came out with their latest data. The labor force participation has also dropped. So actually, you're not just looking at unemployment in as much as defined as people who want jobs can't find jobs, right? Unemployment in the broader scheme also means that some people have just given up. So the figure is actually worse than 5.3 or whatever that definition on unemployment might show. Anyway, to your question, I've been on on your, not this program, but on BFM, speaking on the job guarantee program. This I am really passionate about. I think, you know, Tama is absolutely right. There's institutional, there's systemic reforms that need to be done. All of that can be done and ought to be done. But the biggest and fastest and, in my mind, theoretically most effective way to solve youth unemployment and unemployment at large is for government to take off its blinders, not worry so much about increasing deficit, not worry so much about neoliberal assumptions about how government's spending can affect the economy, and really embark on something really bold, invest in jobs rather than incentivizing the private sector to take up the slack, but rather create an automatic stabilizer. Whenever people can't find jobs in the private sector, the government needs to step in with appropriate employment opportunities that affect long-term economic sustainability. So things like developing a care economy, developing a green economy. I think that's the kind of bold investments that can't, we don't even have to wait for decades for its returns, but we can actually see the good out of it immediately. If the government is brave enough to realize the strength of its position as a monetarily sovereign country that issues its own currency, that doesn't have so much debt in foreign currency, that is by and large in a current account surplus, and therefore doesn't have to worry too much about depreciation or devaluation of its currency, and actually just invest the tens of billions that is required to basically pay salaries of people who do jobs.
Well, assuming you're right and Malaysia is in a position to do that, notwithstanding the consequences of doing so, what you're talking about, Shahril, is addressing the demand side, but the supply side is where some of the concerns lie in terms of the adequacy or the eligibility or the preparedness of graduates in terms of feeding into the workforce. Some people might say Malaysia's education sector is not up to par. Tama, let's have your view on this.
For me, I fundamentally don't think the issue really with unemployment or underemployment is with the education sector. For me, I still blame this system of degrees that we have. So, for example, so this is something that Professor Terence Gomez speaks a lot about in his seminars and his work, is that the majority of Malaysia's economy has actually been dominated by GLCs or politically linked corporations. So, and we're not talking about mega GLCs or mega corporations that run relatively well, like Khazana or TNB or Petronas, right? These are mega corporations who have some level of corporate structure, and therefore there is some level of professionalization. But there are thousands. I'm literally not overestimating this. There are thousands of state, federal GLCs in every aspect when it comes to tourism, when it comes to, you know, picking up trash, when it comes to all this minor stuff. We've essentially privatized government function and given it out to inefficient contractors. So what does this mean? It essentially means that we've crowded out private entrepreneurs. It means that young people have very limited avenues for them to be involved in that economic system. I think that's the first problem. Secondly, we've failed to use even these GLCs well. Right, because if you think about it, if we've privatized government function, at the very least, we should be able to use these tools in an efficient manner. We should be using them, for example, how South Korea used their chaebols, right? In terms of increasing R&D investment, in terms of upskilling workers, and investing more into making better Malaysian-made products, right? But we fail to do that, again, because of we've just basically used GLCs as a way to reward politicians. And I think this really leads to the problems that young people are facing right now. So in my opinion, universities cannot be seen as merely a jobs training organization, right? Fundamentally, universities must be seen as a place to create holistic citizens, holistic education. So that is the core purpose of universities that we cannot run away from. But in a lot of countries, what happens is that there is a private or a private-public partnership where private organizations, so in Malaysia, it could be GLCs, that help to train these young people for certain jobs that they need, help to upskill young Malaysians into certain positions that GLCs lack, for example, right? Yeah. So these are the kind of structures that we don't really have in Malaysia that we should be having. right? Because one, we have too many GLCs, and two, we are not even using the GLCs that we have right now well.
Yeah, that's right, Tama. But there's also the sense that the assumption is that the young want to go into private entrepreneurship when in actual fact they might not be ready to or have the financial capability to do so. And then some might say that the GLC phenomenon has actually acted as a backstop for employment in these troubled times. If it were not for the GLCs and being told to not let go of people, we would have a lot more unemployment. Cheryl, where do you stand in this whole GLC discussion?
I don't have any quarrel with whatever Tama is saying. I think there was a realization maybe about 10, 15 years ago when Tun Abdullah was Prime Minister that there needed to be a wholesale transformation of GLCs, whether in terms of its numerousness or in terms of its, perhaps more importantly, its functions and its processes, right? So I think that realization came a long time ago. I can't help but agree, but that many things need to improve in terms of its corporate governance structures for the many, not the big ones like Tama implied, that would improve. I think the attractiveness of GLCs and its proper function in the Malaysian economy. I'm less in agreement about whether it's too big or whether it plays too big a function in the Malaysian economy. I think it's more the quality of the function and what it needs to be done to become more, I suppose, fairer, more clear in its purpose to actually not just provide jobs, but affect the economy in a tangibly good way.
I'm talking this morning to Cheryl Hamdan, the Deputy Chief of UMNO Youth, and Tama Pile, the co-founder of Undi 18, which is a social enterprise championing a youth-centric agenda focusing on democratic reforms. Gentlemen, we'll come back after this and talk about specific policies, other bread and butter issues, and of course the participation of youth in the future of the country, for example, including election campaigns. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Today on the grill, I'm talking to Cheryl Hamdan, the Deputy Chief of UMNO Youth, and Tama Pile, the co-founder of Undi 18. Now, guys, in terms of specific government policies, PT, PTN, amnesties have been discussed. TVET, training, education, reskilling discussions have been had. HRDF participations as well. And of course, one of the big bugbears facing young people are the student loans, which remain unpaid for the most part. Again, starting with you, Tama, what is your sense of the adequacy of policy and the reforms for the youth so far?
For me, as I mentioned, I think that we've discussed a lot of policies or a lot of ways to try to fix things. But one thing that we haven't really highlighted is Malaysia is fundamentally a very centralized system, right? A lot of jobs, a lot of opportunities come in certain key areas, whether you look at Johor Bahru, look at KL Selangor, and look at Penang, right? These are the key areas where there's job creation, and also even federal jobs are mostly centered around these areas. And I think this is where perhaps, in my opinion, we need to change the way that we develop our economy in terms of decentralizing development. So what we can do, I think, is to copy some policies from the West. So, for example, one interesting policy was to develop around university towns or university colleges. And this is where you can develop a university-centric development model or a development model where the university town itself becomes a nexus where businesses can grow and prosper within rural communities. That's one. Second is that we can improve agriculture access and make sure that more young entrepreneurs are able to access agriculture areas and develop that agro industries. And I think this sort of decentralization is important for a few reasons. One is because you don't want that development to be skewed to urban areas only. Second is that you want to avoid excessive youth flight, which is what's happening for the past 20 years, where young people excessively have just been moving to these major cities, causing a lack of talent, a lack of development within rural areas. So there is that imbalance of population that's going on. So I think these are real issues that we have to solve, but we also have to be very creative about trying to solve it, and not just think about it from a big government perspective, but also think about how do we decentralize that government functions and decentralize development.
Yeah, Cheryl, you're the only representative of the public sector of the three of us. Is there a disenfranchisement among the young in terms of how they're being led in this country?
Oh, that's a big question. Way broader than just this. I don't know. This is just a sense. I think there is definitely a sense that young people feel they it's difficult for them to relate sometimes to the political mainstream and the political processes, both in terms of whether they can relate to political parties that dominate the terrain. I think that's a challenge for everyone. And also maybe some of the disappointments that they faced by let's just put it out there. I think that a lot of them had a lot of hope for Pakatan Harapan. I'm really not making a partisan point. I think some of them, or many of them, got frustrated and disappointed and felt that the whole system failed to deliver on that promise. Because even if PH can't deliver, what else can they hope for? I think that's the sense. And that's the sense that someone like me has to hopefully contribute in correcting or convincing them otherwise. But I think back to this topic, beyond the large sense of difficulty to relate, I think young people, their sense of disappointment has a lot to do with bread and butter issues. So the idea that Tama mentioned about decentralization, I think that's spot on. The problem is we have never come up with a clear idea of how that can happen. We have broad ideas, investing in this area, investing in that area, making sure there's less flight from rural to urban areas. But I think it needs political will to basically mm-hmm. say that the federal government needs to fund a large-scale program that is administered locally. And this has to be something that requires the federal government, whatever party is in charge, to work together with the state government, even if the state government comes from a different party, to work with the local governments, even if the local government is appointed by the state government that's not in bed with the federal government. So that level of political will is what I think people need to demand for and politicians need to wake up to. So if you can give me a minute on what the specific could be, right? I keep talking about the job guarantee program because I think it really solves a lot of things. If the federal government is willing to put aside tens of billions, spread it out to the respective state governments and local councils, the state government and local councils decide based on broad guidelines given by the federal government, what jobs can be funded via this program. So for example, if we think in a particular council or a particular geographic area, there is lack of elderly care, right? A lot of aging population in a particular area. Young people are leaving their homes, so families not really around to take care of their parents or their grandparents. Why don't we have one big federal program that basically trains and provides free state-funded elderly care in, say, geography A, right? Administered by the local council, administered by state government. But money comes from the federal government because only the federal government has the monetary sovereignty to fund something like this. So that's the kind of care economy that I'm thinking about. And obviously there's about far larger things about green economy, what we can do about agriculture, making our agriculture higher up the value chain, all the rest of it, right? All of this has to be administered locally because the federal government doesn't have the sight or the awareness in every particular area, just by design. There's no way you can do that. So I think in the end, like many things in this country, it comes to political will and whether young people in and outside politics are willing to push something as radical as this that I think would change not just our unemployment problem, solve not just our unemployment problem, but all the social problems that we've sort of touched upon in this chat.
I'm talking this morning to Cheryl Hamdan, the Deputy Chief of UMNO Youth, and Tama Pile, the co-founder of Undi 18. Tama, assuming in a blue sky scenario what Cheryl was saying, and we do get the political will, we do get the tens of billions, we do get the money filtered to state governments and local councils, do you fret, are you concerned that maybe for every dollar put into every state, $1 doesn't end up in the hands of the needy. It gets somehow leaked out or put into the wrong pockets. Do you, in other words, remain concerned about the transparency in the governance of this country?
Absolutely. I think mismanagement, government leakages, corruption has been an ongoing issue for the past 30, 40 years. And it's only gotten worse. It hasn't really gotten better because we really haven't put into, institutionalized that system of, making sure that government contracts are transparent, making sure that government procurement is done on a systematic manner. I mean, we've tried to do it, of course, right? But still, there is many cases where there are ways to overcome it. I just had a conversation a couple of days ago where I learned that it's not the main contractors where the corruption happens or leakages happen. It's the subcontracts, right? So, for example, a company might get a mega contract for billions of dollars, but in the subcontracts, in terms of buying the sand, buying the cement, buying all these subsidiary parts and smaller parts of business, that's where all the leakages happen, right? So it's really an ecosystem. So I think that this is where we really need to talk about good governance, and we can't run away from that, right? So of course, I think Sharon and I are very much in agreement that government needs to spend. Government needs to spend in the right manner to empower local communities, empower young people, and we need a radical shift in terms of how we see this country, because right now we're just going on a really bad direction, and we need to turn around. But while we also try to turn around, we need to implement good governance measures to make sure that this money is being used in the right manner, to make sure that every cent that is spent is given in an effective manner. I think a very good example was a report that came out from the AG Chambers, I think a couple of months ago, where it showed that upskilling training, the budget for upskilling for B40 people, I think about 40 to 50% of the money was not given to the right people, was given to companies with defective bank accounts. So these were clear cases of mismanagement of funds, of government leakages. So how do we stop that from happening in the future, especially when we do implement programs that Sharon and I are suggesting, mega infrastructure spending, because we want every single ringgit that's spent on the rakyat to be benefited by the rakyat.
I'm talking this morning to Sharyl Hamdan, the Deputy Chief of UMNO Youth, and Tama Pile, the co-founder of UNDI 18, the social enterprise championing a youth agenda focusing on democracy. We'll come back, gentlemen, after the news and discuss 18 years old as the voting age, as well as the youth participation in the national government. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9. I'm talking this morning to Sharyl Hamdan, the Deputy Chief of UMNO Youth, and Tama Pile, the co-founder of UNDI 18. Now, last we left the gentleman, we talked about corruption and the focus on transparency and governance in the country. I'll start with you, Sharyl, and basically discuss how you are part of a political party whose senior heads are the same individuals that we've seen from two, three, four decades ago. Is this part of the reason why we seem to be stuck in a bit of a time warp and we don't have the policy measures to address what is essentially one of the, if not the most pressing concerns in the country now, which is the youth development?
Can I just make that point that I have to make, which is that my party is not the only one led by a generation of people.
You have a good point.
I agree.
Put it out there. But to your more serious question about whether that is the reason for what we might think as youth disenfranchisement and all the rest of it, perhaps there's an argument that if there's a lack of representation of young people in decision-making positions in political parties, then the political conversation is necessarily skewed against young people's interests or perspectives. So I think there's not much argument about that. But I think beyond just putting all our hopes on more representation of young people, there's also a need to make sure that the young people that get into positions really understand the broad spectrum of what the youth perspective is in this country. And I don't think that is automatic. I don't think if we just put young people into leadership positions, our problem is automatically solved. Because there is these political parties all have their own economy, have their own economy of logic, all have their own cultures and traditions, which themselves need to transform. And I've seen with my own eyes across political parties how young people who enter the realm suddenly begin sometimes parroting what the older generation point of view is. And I sometimes catch myself doing so. No, I'm not afraid to admit there's that whole logic of, you know, surviving. There's that whole logic of making sure you don't step on toes. And before you know it, you not necessarily have lost some of your idealism, but you're like, why did I say that? Why didn't I say that? And catching yourself and having a large amount of self-awareness and having friends outside politics who knew you before politics, I think that's, you know, from personal experience, that's how you ensure you don't go off the deep end. But I've seen colleagues and colleagues from my and other parties who sort of have, and there's no guarantee that I'm strong enough to not do the same one day, right? So that's something that I'm always very cognizant about. And so I think I think the main point here is not just put young people, but ensure young people have the avenues to have private conversations, have avenues to really push their own idealism and their perspective to really represent the young generation that they're meant to represent, rather than stay on just for survival's sake. So that's a trickier terrain to play with, but I think that's a reality that your listeners have to sort of process.
Yeah, so this idea of automatic voter registration for Malaysians aged 18 and above was a real issue, and I think there was a real bipartisan approach to saying yes to it until we had the change in government. There are equal portions of society, gentlemen, who are both pro and con, both for and against 18-year-old voters in this country. The chief opponent of this would be that they don't know what they want at that age, and therefore they might make the wrong decision. But it also means that at the age of 18, when you get to participate in the future of the country, you then get awoken earlier than previously. Both of you, I think, are in favour of 18 years old as the voting age. Let's start with you, Tama. You've actually created your entire social enterprise based on this whole premise. Can you discuss it and, you know, in as distilled a version as possible?
The simple fact is that intelligence transcends age, right? I've met so many brilliant young people in my life, and I'm sure Sharil has, and I've also met an equal number of really, really dumb young people. But I've also met a lot of intelligent older people and also a lot of dumb younger older people too, right? So I think the reality is that our backgrounds shape our growth, and it's not our age that's necessarily the biggest factor. I think that's the first and most important thing. But for the detractors, for people who don't agree with us, for me, my concept is very simple. The idea that at 18 years old or 19 years old, 20 years old, you get your first time voting, I think that's something that's so magical and so powerful, because it makes your university campuses a place where vibrant discussions can happen. Because imagine every single university student is now a potential voter. Like, for example, myself, the first time I was eligible to vote was when I was 25 years old, when I was relatively old, when I was already in the workforce. Where was my space to have discussions and debates in a constructive manner about national policies? But 18, 19-year-olds today, after the lowering of the voting age, have that opportunity to have that debates and discussions in a mature manner in universities. So they have that space. So I think if you want to invest in the future generation, and if you want a better Malaysia, you must give young people the space to debate and understand policies in a mature manner. And I think I just want to touch a little bit about what Sharil said, and also about this point, that it's so important for us to move, to separate politics and policies. And that's what Only 18 has been trying to do. In all our discussions in Parliament Digital, in every single initiative that we do, we want to focus that it's not about which political party you are, it's about that policy-based ideology. Can you stay true to it? And can you advocate for that policy goal? So I think if we can educate young people to focus on policies instead of politics, we'll be in a much better place in Malaysia.
Cheryl, I want to point out that in the last three general elections, especially the last one when Pakatan was actually voted in by the youth votes, politics and the whole framework in this country ignores the youth at their peril. Assuming national elections are called before July next year, which means the youth vote are not automatically voted, registered as voters, does Malaysia's government and its wannabe leaders ignore the youth vote at their peril? Should much, much more need to be done? And specifically, what needs to be done?
Yes, the answer, short answer is yes, they still ignore young voters at their peril, because in the last general election, even without 18-year-olds voting and without automatic registration, we saw the power of the youth vote when they voted as a bloc. I'm not sure if the voting as a bloc will still happen this time around, but one shouldn't assume otherwise just because of the sheer numerousness of young people's voting strength. Secondly, more needs to be done, that absolutely. So we just spoke just now at length about young people's participation, both in political parties and in a political process, being policy-driven and all the rest of it, definitely in agreement. Back onto Undi 18, I just want to say that personally, I'm sort of disappointed as to why it's taken this long to enact the necessary law changes or whatever that's required for the constitutional change that was voted in Parliament to happen in terms of the legal framework, and therefore enacting it, implementing it in the coming GE, if GE comes sooner than the end of term. I've heard some of the logistical problems, and I feel that this is another area that our data collection and our data management ought to be a first world standard, rather than what I'm hearing, which is that it's sort of a bit all over the place and it's taking so much time, or it will take too much time for it to happen earlier than July. So that's a source of disappointment for me personally, because I've always been in support, and I want to say on record congratulations to Tama and his crew for pushing this at the very beginning of this whole journey a couple of years ago. And I've always been in support for this, for the same reasons that I think we've all heard from various people as to why this argument about maturity really doesn't hold water. But what is really important to me is that we don't lose the momentum of getting young 18-year-olds excited about the political process, even if they don't get to vote this time around. And that would be a shame, but we've got to find a way to make them as involved as possible. And that's down to, I think, individuals in all political parties, because political parties oftentimes, focus on the next GE, right? So you can't blame any political party for really focusing on what will get me the votes. But individuals within the parties need to remind their colleagues that it's not just the instrumental reason as to why you should support young people or figure out policies that attract young people. It's also the very intrinsic value of democracy itself. It's also the very idea that this government, whoever wins, will need to be voted in by a broad swathe of people across generations, especially now when generational change in worldview, in perspectives, in experiences is greater than it's ever been before. So for the government to really represent the people, there is a moral and ethical argument for young people to be as involved as possible, if not through voting this time around, but through other ways that all of us have got to work together on.
Well, on those pressing remarks, I'm afraid we've run out of time, gentlemen. So thank you for coming on, and thank you for a frank and open discussion. I hope this is something that we'll be discussing in the months and years ahead. So please do let's keep the conversation going. I was talking to Cheryl Hamdan, the Deputy Chief of UMNO Youth, and Tama Pele, the co-founder of Undi 18, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.